Hello and welcome to the DCI Judge List Summaries for August 2011. We've got in this issue some new documents and web contents I'd like to tell you about, some policy discussions that have happened on the list, and some community and program announcements with some tidbits about recent events tacked on the end. I hope you enjoy this. Okay, documents and web contents. We've got some new judge articles for you. Fabian Peck has given us the two-headed giant FAQ, and Kaya Fedarovic and Eugene Basenhoff have together written a best practices document for draft stamping. Both of those articles are available from the DCI Family Wiki at wiki.dcifamily.org. Then we have four Gathering Magic articles, all by Justin Turner, covering the steps of a turn and turn-based actions, the seven-layer cake, how to avoid a game loss penalty, and don't get DQ'd. Those four articles are available from www.gatheringmagic.com and certainly well worth a read. Some more announcements. Edwin Zhang has announced the beginning of the Welcome to Level 1 project. In fact, you have the first product of it. It's a link to, again, wiki.dcifamily.org. The goal for this project is to be helpful to new L1s, and it's for those who have just got certified and are looking for what they can now do as a judge. John Grant announced a new Wizards Event Reporter build, which brings back the much-respected My Events search option in the DCI Personal Information Centre. There is a summary of changes available at wizards.com. Alexei Gusev has introduced the MTG Archive project. Quite a lot of entries have been added to the database, close to 1,000 apparently. The Archive project was a direct response to Ricardo's request to have a single place that all versions of all languages of all documents could be downloaded from. Having a quick look through the index, just the first couple of things, we've got some Judd articles, we've got the Alara Reborn Conflux, the combined limited deck list, we've got the Alara Reborn FAQs, they're there in German, Italian, Portuguese, English. Skip forward a bunch of pages, we've got the Magic 2012 FAQs, we've got the tournament rules, we've got Scars of Mirrodin FAQ in English, Japanese, Portuguese, Italian, French, English, Chinese. Another English one, this time in mobile format, German, Spanish, Russian. Basically, if you can think of a format or language of a document, you will find it in the MTG archive. So well done there, Alexei. Speaking of well done, Uta Cronenberg, some time ago, apparently about 2 years ago, created a judge booklet. If you've never heard of it, it's an amazing fold-up sheet of paper, really useful for taking the kind of information that you always want to look up whilst you're judging, putting it on a single piece of paper, folding it up so it fits in your DCI judge shirt pocket. The old booklet was literally just a piece of paper for you to print out. The new booklet at www.judgebooklet.com is a fully customizable web app that generates a booklet for you. As an example, the things you can get, you can look for the definitions of free-derived and private information, head judge announcements, layers, casting and activating spells, missed triggers, notes. That's just a blank page you'd write your own notes on. Some simple summary of penalties, resolving spells, copyable characteristics, reviews and feedback, review areas. You can pick 8 of these to fold into your judge booklet. At the moment, they appear to be available in English, a couple of them in German, and is that Czech? I'm not sure. There are languages for you to choose between. And I don't know, how is that simplified Chinese? I don't know my country codes very well, clearly, but it looks like we're looking for translators there as well. So if you want to get some translations in on the judge booklet, there's a great opportunity for you to participate there. So whether you remember the original version of the judge booklet, or if in fact you've never heard of it and have only just been introduced, and you want to contact Uta or Martin Kurler and Sebastian Reinfeldt, who've had a lot to do with the second version of the booklet, then you can contact them at info@judgebooklet.com. I mentioned some mobile devices documents as I was talking about the MTG Archive project. Thanks very much to Ryan Stapleton. He has got the IPG, the JAR, the MTR, Oracle, Comp Rules, Invite Policy, and a whole bunch of other mobile applications. They're all available at the Handhelds Wiki page or at Ryan's website. So that's, again, wiki.dcifamily.org or Ryan's own website, www.bluewizard.net. And finally, Andy Hecht brought us a DCIR penalty file update. If you are still using DCI Reporter, there is some text that you will need to update your penalties.txt file to keep it working. He's given us a link directly to his Dropbox by the look of things. And there we go. That's it for documents and web contents. If you know of a judge article, a new document release, or something that we haven't brought to you in these summaries, then maybe you should be posting to the DCI judge list yourself and making sure people know what you're doing. Let's move on to community and program announcements. Johanna Vertanen has her happy anniversary announcement, and Carlos Ho has his judge advancements. These are announcements that are made each month. Johanna Vertanen gives us a list of judges that have reached their 5 and 10 year anniversaries. You can find them at the community.wizards.com pages. And Carlos creates a list of every new certified judge. There's 115 new judges and 22 new level 2 judges in July from the July 2011 update. That's too many for me to read out here. If you want the full list, again, you'll find those at www.italianmagicjudges.net. Lindsay Hemming is still running his Judge of the Week. Judge of the Week had a brief spot given to the whole of the Australian national team. Week 13 was Brian Koval, and week 14, Gustavo Otero. If you want to know more about those, you can go to the Judge of the Week links. That's hosted at community.wizards.com. You should be able to find them from there. Finally, Carlos Ho announced the Magic Online Judge Open 2011. So what this is, you'll see it abbreviated as MOJO, one of the best abbreviations I think we have in the programme. After the great success of the 2010 MOJO, it's back again for 2011. What this is, it's a free Innistrad sealed deck tournament that you can participate in. It's free for you if you are a judge. We'll know you're a judge because you have an account with DCI Family, and that is how we will know your Magic Online username. If it's not up to date by October, you stand to miss out on this event. So if you are or you know a certified judge who has not necessarily updated their DCI Family profile, get them to do so. They'll get free entry to a sealed deck tournament. I'm just clicking on to find out the date. There's two tournaments. You can compete in either. One of them is on Saturday, October the 29th at 2 o'clock, that's Greenwich Mean Time, so convert to your own country as you see fit. The second of the events is it's midnight GMT between November the 5th and 6th, so the end of November the 5th, beginning of November the 6th, so there's no confusion as to which midnight I mean there. So yeah, sign up to that, get some free Innistrad product. What we'd like to have happen, we don't really want judges to be like sat in their own bedroom on their computer by themselves joining in with the Magic Online Judge Open. Although if that's the only opportunity you have to participate, that would be fantastic. What would be better is meeting up, maybe go to a friend's house, maybe go to an event location, put a bunch of laptops together. Let's have 4 or 5 judges in a local community all get together and all compete together and make that event something very real for your local community. Once again, if you know of any community announcements that haven't made it into these summaries, then perhaps you should be posting them to the DCI judge list so that we all know about them. Let's move on. This time it's we have policy and tournament operations to discuss. So these are things that have been brought up on the judge list and some discussion kind of happened from them. Unless you've been sleeping under a rock, you have probably noticed that there's a new format called Modern. It was first used in the Community Cup that's held on Magic Online, I believe, and recently got its trial by fire in Pro Tour Philadelphia. Simply put, the modern format consists of all Magic sets that were printed since the introduction of the modern card frame. So that's 8th edition, for those of you who don't have memories going back quite that far. There are 21 cards on the banned list, and I suggest if you don't know what they are, you have a quick look over there. As it's obvious hits like Jason Mind Sculptor having been banned from Standard, but some perhaps surprising ones like Ancestral Vision, Dread Return, Balak at the Molten Pinnacle. You owe it to yourself, if you are going to at all be involved in a modern tournament, to familiarise yourself with that banned list. 21 cards is a little difficult to memorise, but you should have at least seen it. Ivan Stevanhoff brought up the subject of taking advantage of the clock at regular rules enforcement level, so something like an FNM. A player admits openly to using the opportunity of thinking his opponent's end of turn to let time run out. How would you rule in this situation? A competitive, it's quite simple, it's a disqualification for stalling. But there's quite a long thread, and I suggest you go to the DCI Judge List Archives and read the whole thread. But the best insight we have is from James McKay, the JAR manager. He says that at regular rules enforcement level, the concept of wrong or illegal, it is less clearly defined, which is intentional. And the intention might get lost in the simplicity of the language that's used in the document. Players should be penalised when they do something which the wider community would think is a bad thing, capital letters, trademark, etc. Use your judging experience and your knowledge and your judgment to correctly apply the JAR. Either way, take the opportunity to educate everyone involved. Explain what your expectations are for fair and fun play. Answer the questions and ensure the players understand what your philosophy regarding this is. Sam Robinson raised an interesting point of outside assistance occurring at an FNM. So, a player's watching an FNM match between two newer players, and a third player interferes, which causes one of the other players to scoop because they think they've won the game. It's like, I win, and they scoop. As it happened, they haven't in fact won the game. I'm not entirely sure of the details of the situation. If you want to read more, then you can look in the DCR Judge L archives. However, James McKay again tells us that official answers to things like this going on are going to be difficult, if not impossible. A couple of points I'd like to make. One is that outside assistance, it's not a serious problem, according to the JAR. It is a general unwanted behaviour. So the correct thing, the correct way to deal with the outside player, player C, would be to tell him why what he's doing is a bad thing, and if the behaviour continues, penalise it with a game loss later. So that's C dealt with. As far as players A and B are concerned, if the game isn't actually over, like one player thinks he's won, but in fact they haven't. Like, they think their opponent's life total is zero, but actually it's one. They dealt 8 poison, and they think that's enough to win, when in fact it's 10. If someone thinks they've won the game and scoops up their cards, that has to be interpreted as a concession. There really is no other way around it. On the other hand, this is regular rules enforcement level. You'll know what flies with your customers in your store. If you can come up with a better solution, and then by all means, try one out, post it to the list later. We might get some useful feedback out of this. There's a deck error scenario at regular L. So Gunnar Holmstedt brought this one to the list. A player realises that he's left a sideboard card in his deck whilst playing an FNM match. According to the JAR, you fix this problem immediately, putting the right card back in the sideboard. If something tricky is happening, like resolving a wish, something along those lines, then obviously do check first that you're not facing a serious problem. But otherwise, no, you just put the card back in its sideboard like it should have been all along. Min Moldova raised the problem, saying that a lot of people have wondered what has happened to the line in the IPG that said, so this is obviously for competitive round now, if cards from the sideboard are lost, note those that are lost, but issue no penalty. This appears to have gone missing from the IPG. As far as we're concerned, this was it was a mistake. It's an issue that will be addressed in the next update. So pretend for now that the IPG really does contain that text. There is no penalty for losing your sideboard. It's not considered a deck problem. There's a very long thread on the list this month called Lying by Omission, brought to us by Carlos Ho. It comes from an actual scenario involving a player turning up to a match, putting his bag on the table, telling his opponent, hey, I just need to nip off to the toilet, is that all right? So he's in the toilet when the round starts, judge comes along, gives a tardiness penalty, and the opponent just sits there and goes, hey, nice free game win for me. The question is this kind of lying by omission to a judge a problem? Is it something we should be on the lookout for? The thread itself, it's incredibly long, so I'm just going to summarise it from Scott Marshall's perspective, official reply. Please do provide good service, good customer service, and be considerate to your players when you're dealing with them and their needs. That does mean you can forgive a tardiness penalty. Tardiness literally means a player not being in their seat at the beginning of the round, but it is forgivable in certain circumstances. A player is not expected to intervene to prevent a penalty for an opponent, but a player may not lie to a judge, and lying by omission is considered to be lying. So, to give a bit of a spin on this, if the judge just gave a tardiness penalty and walked off, the opponent is under no obligation whatsoever to prevent that game loss. On the other hand, if the judge so much as said, hey, where's your opponent? And the guy said, well, I don't know. Well, that's lying. So You'll deal with that the way you ordinarily deal with lying to a judge. Hint, that is a bad thing. Carrying over penalties came up, brought to us by Richard Drivers. A player wants to concede a match after his opponent has been called out by a judge because of a deckless problem. So what happens? Do we assess the game loss and report the result as 2-1? So the game loss is in there, that's the one, but the win goes to the correct person, to allowing for the concession. Or should we make it a 2-0 and apply the game loss in the next round, because this match is effectively already over, it's been conceded. We've ruled that a player can concede any time, but rulings should always be enforced first. They're faster. And so the former option is the most advisable. This should be a 2-1 win, and the game loss is done. Pierre Lacquer raised some concerns about allowing takebacks in a thread called When Is It Too Late? For example, changing which lands have been tapped when you try to cast a spell. There isn't an official answer, again, available for this, because decisions do depend very much on the environment. However, we definitely should discourage rewinds because a player forgot a play they were going to make and started making turn-based actions instead. There is a lot of insight about this from Ricardo Tessitore in his judge report from Pro Tour Nagoya, which is available on blackborder.com. I suggest you go and have a look at that one for more info. Jason McFarland brought up some interesting points with the card Sylvan Library. Now, if you've never heard of the card, well, lucky you. It's a very good card in Legacy, from what I gather. So if you're around Legacy events, you will see this card. The reason for concern with it is it says that at the beginning of your draw step, you may draw two additional cards. If you do, you have to choose two cards in your hand that were drawn this turn, and for each of those cards, pay 4 life, or put the card on top of your library. Now, you might see the problem already. Which cards did you draw this turn? We've decided, finally, after some discussion, Scott Marshall has stated that we will say, for competitive and professional rules enforcement level, that if you do not prove, by keeping your card separate, that the card you're putting back for Sylvan Library is definitely a card you drew this turn, then you won't be allowed to put it back and you will be forced to pay the 8 life. If for some reason that you can't do that, then you may apply drawing extra cards and resolve the game that way. At regular rules enforcement level, please educate the player and encourage good play practices. Okay, it's a tricky decision that the policymakers have been forced to come to here, and respect the difficulty with coming to a good solution there. It's a known Legacy problem. Given that we now have this somewhat new policy regarding the card, it may be a good idea, the next Legacy event that you're the head judge of, to tell anyone in the room that they are under obligation, whilst playing Sylvan Library, to keep their drawn cards separate. There's all sorts of reasons why this might be tricky, fetching a Sylvan Library up in the middle of a turn being an example. But if you have Sylvan Library in your deck, you should appreciate that is a possibility. Cool. More tricky cards. Continue with Bloodlord of Vasgoth, brought to us by Christopher Hickman. The question is quite simple. Bloodlord of Vasgoth gives other vampire spells Bloodthirst. So what happens if we cast a vampire and we put it into play? Some damage has been dealt to the opponent this turn, but we don't put the counters on. What has actually happened? Look at the IPG, section 3.1. A trigger that doesn't have an effect on the visual representation of the game is considered resolved without penalisation. So that deals with Bloodlord of Vasgoth's so-called missed trigger. We do believe, without you having to state anything to your opponent, that the vampire spell has Bloodthirst. So the trigger occurred, the vampire spell has Bloodthirst. Therefore, what you've done is exactly the same as resolving a creature that has Bloodthirst, and not putting the counters on. And that's a game rule violation, because the spell has not been resolved properly. If it's possible, you should back this situation up. CJ Schrader gave us a situation about a player getting sloppy with marsh flats. Now, this is the kind of thing where you put a marsh flats in play, you can crack it for a swamp or a plains. So you crack it, you're intending to go and get a swamp, and just to kind of speed things up, instead of physically going through your library, finding the swamp, put it into play, you just go right ahead and cast a 4Cs or whatever, some kind of one mana black spell. Yeah, you resolve your spell, and then you pass the turn, and now you deal with the boring physical details of actually going through your deck and finding a land, only you go and put a planes into play, which obviously now gives us a problem because you fetched a planes, but you cast Thoughtseize off it. Technically, what's gone wrong here? There's an argument that says, well, the Marsh Rash was resolved correctly, that it was a Thoughtseize that was wrong because you paid the wrong mana for it. But it's a simple player shortcut that's just caused a whole bunch of problems. We can ask the player what it was he intended to search with Marsh Flats. He's going to say a swamp because that's what he got for to save Thoughtseize. And on that assumption, we could definitely allow for this kind of a mid-resolution backup. I don't even want to call it a backup. That's not what we're doing. We're just going to throw the planes back in the library and get a swamp out, force them to get a swamp out. It's kind of sloppy behaviour that's led to it. There's not really. I don't even think there's an infraction here. Just sort it out. Get the land out. Get the correct land out. Now, of course, if the player has a double white card in his hand, then you will want to investigate for cheating. But on the assumption that no shenanigans are there, just take the card away and put the swamp out like it should have been, and give the game rule violation if you think that's warranted. Moving on, Bob Narendra has raised a concern about Consecrated Sphinx. So Consecrated Sphinx says that when your opponent draws a card, you may draw two cards. That's a triggered ability. Technically, after your opponent's drawn, it's a trigger that goes on the stack, and that you should wait to check that the trigger resolves before you then go and draw cards yourself. Shortcuts are defined in the MTR, can be established by players. They can be non-verbal shortcuts. For example, many people will keep their hand on their deck and look at their opponent in order to just kind of almost the eye contact saying, can I go ahead and draw these cards? So if we have some kind of unfortunate event where a player goes ahead and draws cards off Consecrated Sphinx, but before the other player wished to allow them to, it's probably not going to be drawing extra cards. It's almost certainly it's going to be a player communication violation that's involved, that one player believes a trigger has resolved, the other one doesn't. You should educate the players involved to how to correctly use shortcuts. Jason Wong brings us an interesting situation involving an overrun played after combat, or is it? So, player A asks for combat. Player B declares he's going to tap a creature before combat. Then, player B wants to activate Garruk's overrun ability, so like Garruk the Planeswalker's ultimate. So A calls for a judge, and his claim is that, well, we know we're not in the pre-combat main phase anymore, because we've said, well, before combat, and that activating a loyalty ability, which has to be done any time you do a sorcery, must imply that B has actually gone past his combat phase, and we're now in the second main phase, and that therefore B shouldn't be able to attack with anything. The MTR shortcuts do state quite clearly that asking for combat equals passing priority in the beginning of combat step, and unless we're told explicitly otherwise, players are acting in that step. A phrase like before combat or before attackers isn't explicit enough to say that we're still in the pre-combat main phase, so we are acting then. That makes the overrun illegal at that point, because we are in the beginning of combat step, which is not a time which you can ordinarily play loyalty abilities. But we're not going to agree with A's claim either and say that the activating the overrun implies that combat's been skipped entirely. It was an illegal activation of overrun, so that would be a game rule violation. But unless you believe it's just a true kind of miscomprehension over when an ability can be played, it's quite likely you can get out of this situation without assessing any penalties at all, educate players about shortcuts, and just have us back in the beginning of combat phase. You might, if you think that the player really did know he was in combat and tried to activate Garruk's overrun anyway, then there's possibly a game rule violation, there's possibly obviously a fraud DQ in there, but it's entirely possible that you come out of this with no penalties either way, and just some education about shortcuts. Maximilian Schroeder gave us a very interesting situation, which being an amazing corner case, we obviously discussed to death, but it's incredibly unlikely to actually happen in real life sanctioned play unless somebody does this on purpose. Let's say you make an arbitrarily large number of tokens by some kind of infinite combo, let's say Splinter Twin and Deceiver XR, because that's actually in standard at the moment, and then you cast Scramble Verse. Is there even a way to resolve the sorcery? So Scramble Verse would have you flip a coin to determine who the controller of each permanent is, with there being an arbitrarily large number of permanents. This isn't something that you're probably going to do by the time time runs out on the round. The answer to the question, can you resolve this sorcery properly, is probably not. You could try and find some kind of online script that Daniel Schoenbach gave us. We don't really know. If you think about the theory behind the probability, or tokens won't split 50-50 exactly, one player is likely to have an advantage in tokens, and given the numbers involved, that advantage is likely to be lethal. So you can just agree to shortcut it down to a single coin or something. It is a terrifying corner case. You can discuss it on the RC channel or on the community rules board. If you really think this is ever, in fact, going to happen, well, use your judgment. Comprehensive rules, 602.5c, is a rule that states, if an object acquires an activated ability with a restriction on its use from another object, that restriction applies only to that ability as acquired from that object. It doesn't apply to other identically worded abilities. And Federico Donner asked us, can we just have an example of this? We don't understand what it means. So David Hibbs proposed an excellent example. If you control an experiment Kraj and five copies of Basking Rootwaller, and each Rootwaller has a +1/+1 counter on it, then what experiment Kraj has is five instances of Basking Rootwaller's ability. Now, Basking Rootwaller's ability says that this ability can only be activated once in the turn, but Experiment Kraj has five copies of the ability, so he'll be able to activate that ability essentially five times. The restrictions on one ability don't apply to other copies of the same ability. And finally, David de la Iglesia, apologies for pronunciation there, Dave, introduced the Knowledge Pool to us. So the Knowledge Pool, it's a project aimed at creating discussion topics on DCA Judge. Now, you might gather from the length of this very podcast that sometimes we don't necessarily need new discussion topics. We're plenty good at finding ones ourselves. However, creating and posting scenarios regularly to provide everyone with opportunities to discuss, learn and enjoy the DCI Judge list, I think it is a worthy goal. I think it's a great project to be working on. The first topic that came up was to do the interaction between Torp Orb and Seagate Oracle. And for if you would like to join in that discussion or read the Knowledge Pool announcement, then I definitely suggest heading into the DCI Judge L archives and finding that one out. It's a fantastic situation to bring up. And that concludes my policy chats for this podcast. All that's left is to bring up some events from August and some future events heading into September, just so you're aware of them. August 20th and 21st brought us the GP in Shanghai with the head judge Ricardo Testori. Regional coordinator there was Edwin Zhang, and some globetrotters like Christian Gorilovich from Austria, David Magel from Germany, Matteo Caligari from Italy and Philip Hun from Australia managed to attend that GP. Ricardo says, visiting China for the first time in my life, meeting many new judges I've seen only online, getting to work with a new wave of young Chinese judges, and also knowing that some of them will travel to judge in Europe and in the United States, having nice dinners and sightseeing with old and new friends. GP Shanghai is a weekend that that he will remember for a long time. Looking at the other judges' faces and Facebook comments, I believe it was a great weekend for them too. If you want to know more about it, you can check the GP coverage on at wizards.com and see the judge list. With including photos at internationalmagicjudges.net. We also had GP Pittsburgh, it was on August the 27th to 28th, head judged by Kevin Depre, with the second head judge and regional coordinator Eric Shukan, who wants to give his thanks to everyone for another dynamic GP experience in the USA Northeast region. With over 1,340 GP players coming to Pittsburgh, this event qualifies as a huge success. Well, I still think that's quite small, but then I'm used to European GPs. Keep it up, Eric. I'm sure you'll have some massive ones in the US soon. Globetrotters credited for that one are Claire Dupre and Daniel Kitachevsky heading in from France, Federico Donner from Uruguay, my very own Kim Warren from the UK, Nicholas Glick from Spain, and Sebastian Reinfeldt from Germany. They made it all the way over to the US. Well done to them. In September, there was a Pro Tour Pro Tour Philadelphia, September 2nd through 4th, also head judged by Ricardo Testori. It was modern, it was a brand new format, there were new rules, interactions, new tournament situations, new discussions. Can you ask anything more for starting a great weekend? The judge manager on site was Jason Lemahieu? Oh, I don't know. It's been far too long without a Pro Tour on US soil, and I could not be more excited, he says. There'll be a great weekend to come together, have some fun whilst exploring a new format and talk about upcoming changes and challenges. Now, as our summaries have come out after the PT, we know how it turned out. Quite a lot of combo about. Again, look for that coverage at the MagicTheGathering.com website. September the 17th and 18th will bring us a GP in Montreal, head judged by Jeff Morrow. All eyes will be on Montreal for an M12 Limited Grand Prix. To all the judges and players out there, I hope you're looking forward to the event as much as I am, says Jeff Morrow. Regional coordinator there will be Kyle Rick. And we already know that Federico Donner from Uruguay will be heading there as well. What a globetrotter that guy is turning out to be. That concludes the podcast for the August edition of the DCI Judge L Summaries. It's the first time we brought it to you in podcast format. I'm truly interested to know what feedback you have for me as a reader or for anyone who's writing the summaries up. If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to see one again for September, then please let us know. If you hated it, let us know what the hell this could become a one-off thing that we never repeat. Either way, if you want or do not want to see this ever again, please let us know. It's the only way we're going to know how well it's received. Thank you and goodbye.